When I read, I have uncovered 119 Washtenaw County cider mills between 1841 and present, well, you know we're going to be heading down that rabbit hole and finding out more. So come along with me in this here episode 302 of Cider Chat. Hey, 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 my name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world.
Hip, hip, hooray!
We are in our seventh season of Cider Chat, which means if you go to ciderchat.com, which is Cider Chat Central website for sure, you could go to the podcast pull down tab and go to each of the six previous seasons and download those episodes, find out the show notes, and go into like a whole array of information. There's something for folks who just like drinking cider, folks who like dabbling into cider making like myself, folks who are commercial makers. There's really something for everyone. And also, if you like traveling and checking out cideries, this is a good, my humble opinion, this is a very good resource to have to let you know what is out there in the world. And don't we know right now the world's kind of like changing on a daily, weekly basis. And yet somehow, Ciderville, we're going to be continuing on into 2022 because life just keeps on pushing us off the cliff and says, move on, people. Come on. Come on. Don't be dwelling on yourself too much. Keep on getting over yourself. Oh, but you know, I want to dwell on myself just for a minute here, if you would be so kind to allow me, only to say that outside it's very cold, and also outside there is no snow on the ground. So it's now, let's see, it's January 3rd when I'm producing this here episode, and as of this time, we've had only a dusting of snow on the ground. I only had to like sweep off the sidewalk once. I don't really have a sidewalk along the road. I have like a sidewalk from my driveway to my home, which, by the way, when I made that little sidewalk, I put in tubing for radiant heat. So it's an ice melt sidewalk. And I want to tell you, it was worth every hour of back-breaking digging and root pulling out and mathematical figuring out of concrete pouring and setting up the frames to have that little ice melt sidewalk. Yeah, it's kind of nice and quite safe, I'll tell you that, when it's icy out, which I expect it's going to be anytime shortly, and I know we're going to get snow, but it's a little wiggy out there, folks. It's a little wiggy. Anywho, we're going to just stay in happy bubble and listen to a conversation that I recorded, pre-recorded, with Patrick McCauley. He is based in southeastern Michigan, and I adore his story. Oh my gosh, it's so cool what he did. Wrote this whole historical piece on these cider mills in the region, and we're going to be finding out about folks who were building these cider mills, and they were also like Civil War veterans, and how that all kind of came about. And we'll even hear a very untypical story of an African-American family, and a woman to be exact, who owned a cider mill. And at that time, it was based in the middle of the road. And I just kind of love that because, you know, if you're going to have a business and you want to get, you know, have stop people along the way, set up your cider stand in the middle of the road. How freaking cool is that? And I guess, you know, when it was just horse and carriage days, which it was back in the 18 something or other, you could get away with that. But really fascinating discussion that we're going to be uploading momentarily here with Patrick. But in the meanwhile, I'm going to take a little pause here. And when I come back, I'm going to be delighted to speak with you and share with you a little bit about our sponsors for this here podcast.
Walking through the orchards.
The American Cider Association invites you to their 12th annual CiderCon, a global cider conference for cider professionals. CiderCon is taking place February 1st through the 4th, 2022, in beautiful Richmond, Virginia, at the heart of a celebrated cider region. With tours, tastings, educational workshops, demos, and more, CiderCon's return to an in-person event is bound to be one of the most energetic CiderCons to date. Special highlights this year include some amazing tours thanks to the support of the Virginia Association of Cider Makers and the Virginia Wine Marketing Office. CiderCon 2022 will host the first ever overnight tour of the Northern Shenandoah Valley. The Shenandoah Valley is nestled between the Blue Ridge and Allegheny Mountains and is the heart of historic Virginia apple country. The tour will highlight some of the valley's orchards and discussions on growing apples and cider production techniques in the valley. CiderCon 2022 will also feature a tour of Richmond's Jackson Ward. Once known as Black Wall Street for the many financial services, cultural icons, and entrepreneurs who made the neighborhood thrive, Jackson Ward is an indelible part of Richmond's tapestry. This guided bus and walking tour will feature history, food, and of course, cider. Tickets to CiderCon are just $435 if you book by January 20th. To learn more about the wide array of events and educational sessions being offered, and to register for CiderCon, head to ciderassociation.org today. CiderCon is an ACA member event produced with the generous support of their members and the ACA's premier sponsor, Fruit Smart. Now, we know that there are cider events taking place around the world all the time, especially like in the western coast of Spain. They're having a cider celebration every single night of the week there in Asturias and the Basque region. No doubt about that. But this February, it's kind of cool that we have CiderCon happening the first week of February. And then later in the month, up in New York City, is the New York International Cider Competition. And this is the fourth annual cider competition, and it's specifically for commercial makers. So sadly, if you are an aficionado like myself who makes cider on the side, you can't send your cider in to get judged. You can send it to me and I'll let you know how it is. No problem. I love doing that. But this particular competition is for commercial makers and it is specifically geared towards a judging component that is unique in this category of competitions. I don't think there's any other cider competition in the world that is doing this, in that they have the retail buyers, the folks who are looking at the commercial cider and saying, does it meet the price point? Does it hit the style? Are we going to be able to sell it? And let's face it, that's kind of like a whole business plan right there. So don't delay. Go to nyicidercompetition.com. You got to get your cider in now because time is going to be running out. You don't want to be hurrying your cider. You put a lot of love and care into it. You want to package it. You want to make your forms complete and you want to be able to ship it and have enough time to ship it to New York City, where the alcohol professor himself, aka Adam Levy, will receive it and then disseminate the ciders out to the judges. And that judging is taking place at the end of February. So tick tock, folks, let's get it out so that we could be announcing you as the winners for 2022 at the New York International Cider Competition. Go to nyicidercompetition.com. It's time now for our featured presentation, so make sure to grab a glass and join this chat with Patrick McCauley, the author of Washtenaw Cider Mills, as he tells us a bit about his background and then about all the cider mills in this amazing area in southeastern Michigan.
My first introduction to cider was just growing up down the road from a cider mill. I grew up in the eastern part of Washtenaw County, kind of closer to the Detroit area. And we had a cider mill right down the street from us. And so, you know, going to the cider mill was, you know, an activity from a very early age. Our school classes went there. I had never really even thought about hard cider at all until much later on when in my history books, I started reading about hard cider, the hard cider campaign of 1840, William Henry Harrison's campaign, where they were drinking hard cider. And I was like, hard cider, that's kind of interesting. What is that? And And I guess that's just shows how far gone cider was from our collective consciousness, you know, hard cider, at least. The sweet cider, cider mill donuts, that type of thing really lingered on here for a long time and continues to this day. And I think that's what, if you're lucky enough to have cider mills near you, it's the sweet cider and donuts type. Huh. And which is amazing, by the way. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So when I was in college and studying history at University of Michigan, I started reading about the hard cider campaign of 1840. And I was always very interested in American history. And so history was kind of my introduction to the world of cider outside of just standard cider mills that we had, you know, in our county. And then I started drinking and realized that I really liked hard cider. And the reason I've really gotten into home cider making is because, frankly, it's hard to find the type of cider that I enjoy drinking. The wild fermented kind of funky stuff, that's what I like. Mm-hmm. And I had lots of sources of apples around here, so I just decided to make my own.
Since we're talking about cider mills, what is your like setup for pressing your apples?
My home cider making started with a 1900 era grinder and basket press, where you turn the crank. Yep. And, you know, that was good when you're making like 30 or 40 gallons a year. But one of my good friends, Martin Thoburn, who's a accomplished cider maker, he had his own, he's got a Spiedel mill mm-hmm. and a rack and cloth press that he built. And I'm like, that's what I need. Mm. And so in the last few years, that's what I've been using is a rack and cloth press that I built from a Harbor Freight shop press. Mm. And then I bought an electric grinder. And since then, it's been easy to make. It's easy to make hundreds of gallons of cider if that's what you know, if you've got the right equipment. So,
yeah, no doubt. So with that Harbor Freight, which folks out in the rest of the world might not be familiar with that store here in the U.S., that is like a bench press in a way, I think you would call it, like a freestanding piston driven press. Is that correct?
It's basically the external frame of a rack and cloth press. Mm-hmm. And then it has a mounted 20 ton jack on it. Mm. And you can get a lot of pressure with that 20 ton jack. You can actually bend the press, which I've done.
Wow.
And then I just built the frames. I built the frames myself and the racks myself.
Did you set it up where you could do two racks at the same time when one is being pressed? You could be setting up the next one.
That might be a future improvement because the press is the choke point in the cider making operation, not the grinding, it's the pressing.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's lots of room for improvement on my design, but as of right now, I'm probably putting a couple hundred gallons through it a year, pressing a couple hundred gallons for myself and for friends.
Wow.
And it's a lot of fun. And I'm hoping that I'm turning more people on than off when I give them a bottle of my cider.
I have a feeling you are. It sounds like you're very accomplished. And what I do find in this trade, whether you're commercial or not, you have this background in, well, you wrote a book, right? Let's just talk about that for a bit here. You wrote a book about architectural history of the region. And
I live in Ann Arbor, and so that's what the book is on. It's called Historic Ann Arbor, an Architectural Guide.
And it's 400 pages. My goodness. Right. That's pretty righteous.
425 pages.
Oh, my God. So, I mean, that kind of goes hand in hand with somebody like yourself who's like renovating, has this interest in the old, bringing it into the new again, and then also taking these old techniques of cider making, the classic way of wild ferment, and bringing it into the 21st century. It's just amazing in that way.
And that's sort of where my love of cider came from, was just those history classes and finding out about it and seeing that it was a big part of American culture. And I'm like, why is this gone?
Yeah.
And trying to figure out why that was gone. That was part of what inspired me to kind of dig deeper into the history of cider in the area.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this paper that you wrote here. When did this actually get written by yourself, all on the cider mills in your area? And can you pronounce this county for me again so I could get it correct pronunciation?
Washtenaw. It's a Native American word. I'm trying to remember the exact meaning of it. Something about the river, because the county has a couple major rivers running through it. The Huron is the one that runs through Ann Arbor mm-hmm. and Ypsilanti, the two biggest cities in the county. Mm-hmm. And then in the southern part, there's the River Raisin, mm-hmm. which that was actually named by the French because of all the wild grapes growing along the banks of it. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, Washtenaw, it's a Native American word that has to do with the rivers that run through the county. I think something about the Grand River or something like that.
The people living there before it was colonized, the Native Americans, there wasn't much on necessarily them doing anything with cider. Is that true? Is that what you found?
Yeah. So I had tried to figure out, because in Annie Brennan's book, he had talked about in upstate New York, I think it was maybe the Iroquois mm-hmm. were cultivating apples, you know, mm-hmm. at the time of the revolution. Mm-hmm. And since there was so much trade going on, even in Washtenaw County and Detroit area, very early, Detroit was founded in 1701. I had tried to figure out if, you know, the Indians of the area were actually growing apples, and I couldn't find anything conclusive written about it. I can pretty much guarantee they were, because, I mean, they were trading with the French. The French were growing apples. The French planted apples in Detroit in 1702, the year after it was founded. Mm-hmm. And so they were trading with the French. They were very agricultural. Around where we live now in our part of the county, it was a lot of oak openings, like they had burned out the undergrowth and they were farming under the oak trees and in these oak savannas. And so I'm pretty certain they were either growing wild apples from seed. Mm. But again, the historical data on that is just non-existent. And that's actually what kind of inspired me to dig more into this, is because I think the story of apples and cider in America is very incomplete and very generalized. Like whenever I see a history of it, it's a very general, broad brushstrokes sort of story of cider. Like, you know, it was the most popular drink in America during colonial times. And then by the 19th century, it was waning because of all the German immigrants and their breweries, et cetera. And then by Prohibition, it was done. You know, it's actually much more nuanced than that. And I wanted to find primary sources that actually talk about, you know, what was actually happening at the time versus, you know, what somebody's recollection of what was happening. I wanted to find actual sources and try to piece together the story that way. Mm-hmm. And the best way, and because I had written a book about local history and I knew a lot of the resources that were available in, you know, from the libraries around here, from the internet sites that I'm tuned into, I thought doing a hyper local search would be one way to find out more. Mm-hmm. Like, what was actually happening in 1850? What were they doing? You know, how much cider were people drinking back in the 1800s mm-hmm. Or the 1700s for that matter? Mm-hmm. And that's what I kind of set out to find out when I started researching this paper. And the research kind of began years ago when I was writing my previous book, which came out in 2014. I kept researching these houses around Ann Arbor that were orchards. They were farmhouses now surrounded by houses and neighborhoods, but these were farmhouses that were, you know, kind of small orchard settings, like 7 or 8 acres of orchards. And I was like, oh, wow, the town was surrounded by orchards at this time, you know, in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. And once I started getting into that, it started making me think, well, they had to be making cider. And then I started digging into that a little deeper and, mm-hmm. and found out, yeah, they were making a lot of cider and there were literally hundreds of cider mills.
It's like 119 originally?
No, there was way more than that.
Okay.
And actually, since the that article got published, I found probably another 20-something mills. So this is an ongoing research project that will probably never end. So I think I'm up to 135 documented mills. And these are just ones that I was able to document. I think there were, you know, literally hundreds of others that were smaller and just never made the papers, never made it onto the census records, never made it into any advertising. You know, they were just some guy that was pressing cider for himself and his neighbors, you know, in his barn. I think there was a lot of that going on.
Is that how how do you differentiate that? Or when you say like 119 in your paper, and now there's even more, are these weren't commercial operations necessarily. They're just perhaps just somebody who has a cider press like you and I making cider in the backyard. Is that how you broke it down?
No, most of them were actually commercial mills.
Okay, good.
Right. One stat I found was that in 1909, there were 102 cider mills in Washtenaw County. And this is just mentioned in a paper or in the paper. There was a meeting of the Washtenaw Cider Makers Association back then. And they're like, we have 102 members. And, you know, again, those were varying sizes from large steam powered cider factories that were producing, you know, thousands of gallons of cider a day to, you know, probably the backyard operation that was just pressing he and, you know, their neighbor's apples, something like that. But there were actually quite a few that were quite large, but I think they kind of ran the gamut.
What do we know about the association?
Kept finding that they were meeting every year in the early late 1800s and early 1900s. And then I just stopped finding references after Prohibition. It just kind of disappeared.
Ah, they went underground, I imagine, in some way.
Or they just went under.
Yeah. It wasn't easy. I mean, it's so sad to think about that, isn't it? Over and over again on where we would be today in the U.S. had we not been struck by Prohibition.
Rhea, the interesting thing that I don't think most people know about, and frankly, I wasn't that aware of it. I heard little stories here and there about Prohibition in the 1800s, you know, long before 1920, is that there were a number of states that banned alcohol back in the 1850s. And Maine was one of them. I know Vermont was one of them. And then Michigan, because everyone was from Vermont and Massachusetts and New York, kind of brought those Puritan kind of ideas about, you know, self-improvement and making society better by eliminating alcohol. Michigan became the first state in the country in 1845 to pass a local option law. This was something I didn't know about until I had researched the paper. And the local option law basically allowed for any local municipality to ban the sale of alcohol. So there were a number of counties in Michigan that did this, a number of local cities and towns that completely banned the sale of alcohol. And like, for instance, Calhoun County, which is just west of us, a couple counties over, kind of that's where like Battle Creek is, they banned alcohol in the mid-1800s. And so Calhoun County was one of the leading producers of cider in the state in, say, 1864, but they shortly after that banned alcohol. And there was a lot of debate going on locally about banning alcohol. And that was one of the, I found a lot of funny and interesting stories in the paper, like during the debate here in Washtenaw County in 1888, they were trying to pass a local option law where they were going to ban alcohol in the county. And the Germans just weren't having any of it. And Washtenaw County has a huge German population, which maybe we can talk about a bit more, because the Germans get a lot of blame for the decline of cider in America, just because they came in such huge numbers in the 1850s. And the Germans were pretty much the main reason that Washtenaw County did not become a dry county back then. They like their beer and cider.
Yeah. They voted it down, right?
They voted it down, yeah. And there was another earlier ban on alcohol in Michigan in 1853. They were trying to follow the what Maine had done by banning the sale of alcohol. And so that actually passed the legislature, but got struck down at the Supreme Court. So this so-called Maine law would have banned alcohol back then, and we would have gone on a completely different trajectory as a state in terms of the number of cider mills that sprang up here and the amount of, you know, cider and vinegar, hard cider and vinegar that was made here.
Did you see any kind of correlation to that on what was happening politically in the country at the time and either the pro-alcohol movement or the anti-alcohol movement?
Immigration and the huge influx of Irish and Germans that came into America you know, starting in the 1840s, was one of the main, I think one of the main reasons Prohibition really took off. You know, I think it was very, very, very much based on kind of an isolationist, keeping these, you know, Catholics that like to drink out, you know. So I think a lot of those reformers that were trying to ban alcohol, there probably was a nativist sort of element to that. You know, at that time you had the Know Nothing Party. You know, in the 1850s, there was the Know Nothings, which were an anti-immigrant party. And they, again, a lot of it was intertwined with the prohibitionist movement. Then there was just a lot of people that wanted to make society better. You know, a lot of the suffragettes were prohibitionists too, you know, just because women bore the brunt of, you know, their husband's alcoholic behavior. And so, you know, we're making families stronger. I think there was a lot of movements going on for reform at that time. But again, these German immigrants and Irish immigrants, they were not into it.
Another reason to love them for that, for sure. I want to talk about some of the little pieces here that I thought were kind of cool. The Chicago Apple King. What a great title to have. Now, Chicago is not Michigan, it's Illinois. But so here was somebody based in Michigan, in the county, in the Washtenaw County, and had this mill and was exporting so much to, I guess, which would be assuming then to Chicago itself, that the, David Hennings became known as the Chicago Apple King.
So David Henning was a Irish immigrant who, I don't know exactly what year he came to Michigan, probably in the 1830s, I believe, because that's when the big Michigan land boom took place. Vermont cleared out all these states in the East. Everyone was looking for brighter futures, and the sons of the people that settled upstate New York came to Michigan because it was the West. And David Henning came from Ireland, came to Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti, which is our neighboring city to the east, and he started a barrel making business. Apparently he overmade barrels one day or one month, he filled them full of apples and then sent them on the railroad to outside markets. And it was so successful that he just kept doing that. And eventually was exporting 100,000 barrels of Michigan apples and cider every year to Chicago.
Chicago and beyond too, a little bit outside. Would that be over to other border states or?
Absolutely. And that's, I think, one thing that's kind of interesting to think about is travel back then. We always think about like what people were drinking locally. And that's actually what I set to find out is what were people drinking locally? I assume that most cider was consumed, you know, within 10 miles of where it was produced. And I think that may be the case. But a lot of it was being shipped all over. So, for instance, in the 1830s, you could get old New York vinegar here in Ann Arbor. Wow.
Isn't that something? And, wow. I wonder, would that be coming in on a train then, do you think?
So no, the basically Michigan was really, really late to be settled because it was hard to get to. And so once the Erie Canal opened in 1825, it allowed steamboat traffic from Buffalo to reach Detroit, and then, you know, obviously other ports in Michigan. And basically things were being shipped by boat to the Erie Canal and then sent to New York that way, or vice versa.
Right. So that's a good kind of geographical piece here for listeners out in Ciderville to know on how Michigan is set up, because it's kind of surrounded in a way by the Great Lakes. Right. And so that, and that was a major avenue coming in via the Great Lakes, kind of connecting down and bringing goods and, you know, all the different cargoes.
Yeah. And another thing to think about too is that the like Ypsilanti, for instance, which is the town east of Ann Arbor, it's a college town, sort of a post-industrial college town, very charming, a lot of historic architecture there. That was on the main road from Detroit to Chicago. And so as of the 1820s, there was it was an old Indian trail that became one of the first territorial roads that ran west from Detroit. And those were the places that got settled first. And then by 1839, 1840, the railroad reached Ann Arbor from Detroit, and then they were built. They built a railroad basically by the 1840s that had reached Chicago. So, you know, that opened up huge markets. Chicago was a boom town. Detroit was a boom town, big manufacturing centers. And so those goods could be shipped basically all over to the eastern states. And that was one of the, again, one of the surprising things I found, because I just thought it was a much more local economy, but it really was not a local economy. Even in those very early days, people were, I actually found stats about how much cider was shipped on the Michigan Central Railroad in 1841. It wasn't much. It was like 50 something barrels. But, you know, the global economy or the national economy was already happening here in the 1700s. Like Detroit cider was being exported by the 1730s, which was kind of interesting. Even before Michigan really was populated in 1818, I think Detroit had exported like 800 barrels of cider to outside markets, which doesn't seem like a lot, but, you know, for a small frontier settlement with nobody living in it, that actually probably was a pretty decent exportable crop.
Would that be going then to Chicago, or would it be then going further west? Because, you know, I mean, think about how they would be sending IPA, India Pale Ale, from England down around, you know, the Africa. I mean, that's a long distance in a ship. So were these going out to, do you know the areas that they're going, east and west, or?
East and west, I assume. Yeah, Chicago, I think, was founded in 1830. And again, it just sprang up really quickly in the middle of a swamp, you know, and it was just one of those boom towns, you know, that was fueled by lumber and, mm-hmm. you know, trade and mm-hmm. manufacturing. And, you know, it was the railroad between Detroit and Chicago was very, very, very busy, and still is to this day. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so Ann Arbor was right on that railroad. Ypsilanti was right on that railroad. So all these mm-hmm. cities, and Ann Arbor kind of became known as a manufacturing center before it was a college town. I mean, it was a college town very early in its history, but it was such a small college at the time that, you know, people were making farm implements and shipping them around America. Mm-hmm. And so it was known for other things long before it became known as a college town. And again, those Michigan apples that were being shipped and the cider that was being shipped from the railroad depot all over America, you know, that was one way that, you know, somebody like David Henning, he was, I think, Ann Arbor's first millionaire. Mm. And he made millions of dollars by shipping apples.
Wow. Isn't that something? I'm wondering if they were shipping those barrels to be able to then distill the cider that was in there.
I'm not sure. So that's the other thing I think that's probably worth discussing is, you know, I think in this day and age, you and I, we like hard cider. That's sort of our, you know, how we got interested in the whole idea of cider, but cider was so many other things to people in the past. I mean, hard cider was, I think, the bulk of what it was used for. It was cheap alcohol. Mm-hmm. It was easy to make alcohol. It makes itself. You just put it in the barrel and it turns into hard cider. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. It doesn't, mm-hmm. you don't have to malt the grains and, mm-hmm. you know, all that stuff that they have to do to make beer, heat mm-hmm. up the wort, all that. Mm-hmm. It's very easy. It just makes itself. But back in the 19th century, or even in the 18th century or the 17th century, you know, other products were made from this, like cider vinegar. That was one of the things that I was really surprised about. And that actually seemed to be almost a bigger industry than the hard cider business. Mm. Cider vinegar, and the only way I knew about this was I kept finding references to a cider mill that burned down. Like in 1867, this Ypsilanti cider mill burned down and there was 800 barrels of vinegar that went up in flames, which was a huge loss.
That's huge. 800 barrels. Right. My goodness.
There was another one that burned down in Ypsilanti in 1895 that had, it was like 1400 barrels of vinegar that went up in flames. And so just to kind of, you know, that made me think differently about cider. Oh, cider was more than just this sweet cider you get right when it's pressed and kids love it. Everyone loves that. And then obviously adults and children were drinking hard cider back then. But cider vinegar was such a massively valuable product mm-hmm. and useful product. They mm-hmm. used it to refine white lead, which they used to paint all the buildings white back then. So they mm-hmm. needed a lot of vinegar to make the white lead. And then obviously vinegar was used in pickling and cleaning and as a health tonic and all these other uses that it had. So it was almost more valuable than, you know, the alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was another thing that I kind of discovered too, that was sort of interesting, is that, you know, they always tell you never to make your vinegar next to your cider, never do that because they will cross contaminate. But I kept reading about the same mill, they were making cider and vinegar in the same place. Mm-hmm. And well, why was that? They probably didn't care. You know, if your cider turned to vinegar, well, you needed that too.
Mm, yeah, win-win, any way you look at it. Such an amazing way that apples keep giving and giving and giving. It's kind of like having a good dog, right? You know,
they're exactly.
Just unconditional love of the apple.
And Rhea, one thing I would add to that mm-hmm. is, and this is something I've always been interested in, is the intersection of, you know, cultural practices and technology. So, you know, when Ann Arbor was founded, it was founded like, and same thing with all the towns all over southern Michigan, they were founded like people had been founding villages in New England and Virginia and New York for, you know, a couple centuries before, where you needed water power and you needed to build on the river so you could power your mills. Mm-hmm. Now that we had plenty of water power here, but something like a steam engine totally changed that. And cider mills started springing up everywhere because you just had a steam engine to power it. It powered the grinder, it powered the press, and it also increased the yield because you could make a bigger mill that, you know, the power was, you had more horsepower, so you could grind more apples faster, you could press mm-hmm. them faster. And so that was one of the interesting things I found, is that it literally became an industrial business where, mm-hmm. you know, people were producing as much as 3,000 gallons a day. That was one, there were a few mills around town where they're like, oh, they pressed 3,000 gallons last Saturday. I was like, 3,000 gallons, that's a lot of cider.
It sure
is. They were churning out 80 barrels a day in some places, 20 barrels a day, you know, things that probably were not even imaginable if you had been sitting here in 1850 trying to press cider. By the 1860s, it was a mass production enterprise, and with, you know, perhaps $10,000 in capital going into this cider mill back then.
Which is a lot of money back then. And there must have been like other elements to that business, because you have to have the apples. And so you have to be able to store the apples to be able to press 3,000 gallons. My goodness. What in your research did you find about the mills themselves? Were they a standardized kind of setup with the same kind of structure? And, you know, the apples came on the top floor and then dropped down into a grinder and then dropped down into a press?
The technology, again, was something that kind of interested me. And in the 1830s, the settlers that came here from New England were commenting on how the French made their cider and how it was sort of this old-fashioned method where they literally had the wheel and the trough to grind the apples. And they had these interesting presses that were like I think it was like a lever press is what you would call it, where it's just a big oak timber that came down and provided the force. And that was something that, you know, labor-saving technology, 19th century farming was all about that. And Ann Arbor was a big center for the manufacture of labor-saving farm technology, mm-hmm. like seed drills and cider mills and all these, mm-hmm. these different things. You know, they were made at an industrial scale, sold to farmers for cash, and then the farmer could, you know, justify the expense by increasing their, you know, efficiency. Mm-hmm. And that's basically the story of 19th century cider making, is starting off with the trough, with the horse-driven wheel, and then ending up with a steam engine and a steam-powered press that could press, you know, thousands of gallons in a day.
Wow. And they were pressing that juice, putting it directly into barrels?
That's what they said. Yeah, mm-hmm. sulfured barrels. That's they would press the juice and it would go straight into a sulfured barrel. And then people would haul that away from the mill. You take your apples to the mill and drop your barrels off, and then you just come and pick them up mm-hmm. And take them back to your farm. Mm-hmm. One interesting note was I found so many people killed in the making of cider.
Oh no.
It was really dangerous, apparently. People getting caught in the grinder, people, you know, getting, you know, having barrels land on them. If you think about moving a, you know, a hogshead of cider down your basement steps into the cellar, how dangerous that would be. Wow. I don't know what that weight is. I know a 55-gallon barrel weighs 100 pounds on its own, mm-hmm. and then you throw 55 gallons of cider in it. You can do the math and see mm-hmm. that would be tricky. I found four guys that were killed while moving cider barrels down into their basement, just locally.
Well, we're going to have to raise a glass to them for sure, and all the others who kept the tradition alive. That's amazing. Wow. Well, it is an industrial, you know, activity. No, you know, it's a trade, industrial. And even today, cider makers, you know, anybody thinking about getting into it commercially, you know, it's very custodial, and you have industrial accents, unfortunately. And we lost one of the pioneers of modern cider movement today, Terry Maloney at West County Cider was killed in a cidery by a valve.
Be careful out there, people. Yeah. It's no joke. Cider Chat took a dark turn.
Well, it's the reality of the sport, I guess. My goodness. I wanted to talk a little bit about Martha Array Day and mm-hmm. what you found out there, because that's a really fascinating story, and it's a piece that we don't hear often about in terms of our history here in America. Can you talk about that family and their mill?
Yeah, so this was kind of interesting in a couple ways. So first of all, I only found one cider mill that was even partially owned by a woman, and that was this Martha Array Day, along with her sister, Jacob Array. Now, the Arrays were a very interesting family. I believe they came from New Jersey originally. And they were one of the first African-American families to come to Washtenaw County. And they came in the late 1820s. Jacob Array had served under George Washington in the American Revolution. And part of his, you know, I guess, payment for his service was a land grant in, you know, on federal lands. And so they came to Michigan very early in the settlement of our area in the 1820s. His son, Asher Array, took over the farm in 1829. And the farm was a stop on the Underground Railroad, which was also ran through Michigan. Detroit was one of the main stops on the Underground Railroad. So the Array farm was one of the stopping points before you got to Detroit on your escape from the South. Asher's son, Jacob, and his daughter, Martha, took over the farm after his death in the 1870s, and they ran a cider mill on Michigan Avenue. And I found quite a few mentions of them in the papers. You know, the Array cider mill is up and running. You know, this is going back into the early 1880s. And then there was a lawsuit because they had actually built the cider mill in the road, or enough in the road that it was causing problems. So there was lawsuits, and they had to prove the value of it. And that's where I found a little bit of information about how much cider they were making. They apparently made 1500 barrels one year, and the mill cost, you know, like $1,400 to build. And so it was actually a pretty decent sized operation. And the railroad company that was trying to take over their land was like, there's no way this mill produced 1400 barrels of cider. And you know, so it was kind of interesting, the back and forth that was going on in the papers that I could find. But as far as I know, that's the only African-American cider mill that I've ever seen documented anywhere. I mean, I'm sure there were in the South. I know Thomas Jefferson, a couple of his slaves made cider, but I've never found one that was owned by an African-American family. So the Array Day Cider Mill in Pittsfield Township, Michigan, was probably one of the few.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for doing that research. And $1,500 back in that day, that's like $1 million. I mean, I can't even
it was a lot.
Fathom. I wonder if that would have been from being in service in the military, or was this?
They were prosperous farmers, actually. Uh-huh. That's what all the article, it's kind of, you know, they sort of kind of preface everything as like, because they were black. Oh, they were actually prosperous, though, which was kind of interesting. You know, everyone was racist, or the papers were very racist back then.
Yeah.
But yeah, they apparently were prosperous farmers, and that was again part of, you know, the farm industry. All of these farms had, you know, little side hustles, as we'd call them today, where you were, you know, trying to just make the farm profit a little bit better. So maybe we'll build this cider mill. Maybe we can, you know, make extra money doing that. And you borrow money to do it, or you save money to do it. And then, you know, they, that cider mill was in operation for at least 20 years and possibly more.
That's fantastic. It's really a testament of the time and just that enterprising, you know, just put the shovel to the ground and keep working. I love this story too. You know, it's Detroit's kind of coming back slowly more and more. To hear these type of stories of folks who don't often get written about in history is really, really key. And I imagine that there's descendants in that area who are probably...
Yeah, they still live around here.
Yeah, no doubt. What an amazing thing. And for a woman to be running something like that too, that's not something you see either. So it's really remarkable in that way. You sent another photo, and we're going to have these photos in the show notes of the kids drinking ciderkin. And why don't we talk about the image too, and your thoughts about it and finding that particular image, what it actually looks like for listeners.
So I actually think they were drinking sweet cider. That's my thought. I assume it was sweet cider. I don't know that for a fact. We just have this image from 1935 outside the Dexter Cider Mill. Dexter Cider Mill, Dexter is the town immediately west of Ann Arbor. It's a really scenic town on the Huron River. The cider mill is built right on the Huron River, and it's this old 1880s cider mill built by two Civil War veterans. And it's the oldest continuously operated cider mill in Michigan. It's not the oldest cider mill, but it never shut down even briefly. So it's been running every year since 1886. And they are kind of an interesting survival story of, you know, all the cider mills that went out of business, you know, because of prohibition, because of changing tastes. Dexter Cider Mill just keeps going. They're not owned by the original family anymore. I think they're on their third owner, but it just keeps running the same way it has been. They just make traditional unfermented, unpasteurized sweet cider and some of the best, you know, cider donuts you'll ever taste. So, and that was one thing we probably should talk about a little bit is this, you know, sweet cider and how popular that always was. I think, you know, you go back into the 18, I was finding in the 1860s, people trying to find ways to prevent their cider from fermenting, you know, just because, you know, it was a great source of calories and vitamins throughout the winter. But if you were a teetotaler, you know, you couldn't necessarily get those benefits from, you know, the hundreds of bushels of apples your small orchard turned out every year. And so sweet cider was always popular going back into the 1800s. People loved to drink it. I kept finding references of people that loved to drink the cider right as it just started to turn. You know, they just, they liked that flavor.
A little fizzy. It'd be a little bit fizzy. I think that's what the kids are probably drinking because I want you to kind of continue on that thread, but I want to note that earlier you had mentioned a sulfured barrels. And so they're putting the cider directly into a barrel that probably had a sulfur stick burned in there, right? And that, that would help with it as a preservative and kind of anti, you know, microorganisms growing in there. But so if those kids were drinking out of a barrel that was really sulfured, well, it is going to have a little bit of an impact on the taste. So, you know, at least for a couple days there until the cider starts taking over. I think they're drinking ciderkin, which would be a watered down barrel, perhaps.
There was, I mean, people were making ciderkin here. I found a guy had a recipe for boys' cider, like cider for small boys, and I think that's what it was. It was probably a watered down ciderkin type drink. Yeah. But sweet cider was, you know, really popular always. Obviously, it would turn really quickly. You know, sometimes in days, sometimes it takes weeks. I mean, and I know that from my wild ferments, you know, some of my wild ferments, I'll put them in the barrel and they'll just be sitting there for a month sometimes before they really start to ferment. And so I think people were down there taking a swig from that, you know, all throughout the process.
Did they have a way that they preserved it from going? You were starting to talk about that. What were they trying to slow the ferment?
Oh my God. They were putting all types of horrible chemicals in it.
Ooh.
And they're like, it won't affect the flavor. Like, there's no way that, you know, pasteurizing it affects the flavor, you know, but they were putting all types of compounds in there in somebody's patented blend of God knows what going into it to prevent it from fermenting. But it really never took off until the early 20th century with ice houses and refrigeration and things like that, where you could actually prevent it from starting to ferment, or at least for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks while you sold it or could consume it. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing when you get the unpasteurized cider here. You know, it's really good for about 2 weeks, and then you start taking sips of it and you're like, oh, I think this is starting to turn.
I mean, 2 weeks is a long stretch. I wonder if they were canning it at all, because that's, I know a cider maker here at one time, I don't know, early 90s or something, who would pick the apples, press the cider, and then actually put it in a mason jar and can it to stop, mm-hmm. you know, basically pasteurization. Anything about that?
Well, that's that was something that people did. And it was interesting because some of these bigger cider factories, I never found that they were advertising the selling of hard cider, but they were selling purified cider and things like that. So it must have been, you know, to have any sort of shelf life on it, it must have been basically pasteurized. And mm-hmm. we have to remember that people didn't even realize how fermentation worked until the 1850s or so. We didn't know that it was these yeast, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. basically converting the sugars to alcohol. And so it was, you know, it was shortly after that that people realized how you could preserve cider by boiling it or canning it, you know. And, you know, technology too changes how we do everything. The availability of cheap canning jars, you know, that wasn't really a thing until the late 1800s, you know, something like glass bottles. You have to remember everybody was drinking flat cider, basically. It was, you know, still, you know, uncarbonated cider, basically until, you know, bottles became cheap enough and strong enough, you know, for the average person to buy them. Mm-hmm. And I kept finding recipes for how to make champagne cider. And a lot of the manufacturers mm-hmm. around here made champagne cider. And that's just because we, you know, cheap, strong bottles were finally available by the 1860s. Wow. And you could actually do that either in a home scale or at an industrial scale at your cider mill, where they were actually selling champagne cider.
Were they promoting a particular yeast, or just on how to bottle condition it?
How to bottle condition. Again, people didn't know how to bottle condition because you had never done it before. Mm-hmm. So I found a really great article from 1863 where they tell you how to do it. I've actually been trying to follow the recipe this year. The only thing I haven't done is I haven't put pineapples into the barrel yet. That's what they recommend doing.
And any reason why pineapples? And imagine getting pineapples back then. Holy cazoli. Wow.
Yeah, they're like, if you can get cheap pineapples, put 4 or 5 crushed up in the hogshead.
Interesting. Boost up the sugar, I suppose.
Maybe. Yeah, it basically was a technique of multiple rackings. Okay. And I actually had shared this article on the Cider Workshop. That's one email thread that I follow. And I'm just trying the approach. It involves multiple rackings really early in the process to basically cripple the fermentation. So you have residual sugar. And then they said to let it ferment for 3 months after you've done 4 rackings. And then bottle it. And they're like, a few bottles may break, but that will just have to do.
Just not be there when they're breaking. I love that, because we think, oh, adding pineapple is a new method in cider making today. Of course, people are trying to make pineapple flavor. They probably weren't doing it for the flavor necessarily.
No.
Who knows? But I think it's cool to see it then, that you have that in the records. It's adding something into the juice itself is really not something that's necessarily new. Over and over again, we see that.
Exactly. And I was talking to an old farmer that lives down the road from me. he grew up in the 1940s and 50s. His farm family had been there since, I think, the mid-1800s. They're still on their original land. I was like, hey, John, do you remember any of the old timers making cider? He's like, they all did. And this was back in the 40s and 50s, long after cider's heyday.
Wow.
Apparently, all these old German farmers were still making it long after, you know, the average person had stopped, had given up on it.
So much in this article, Patrick. I think we just hit upon just the edge of it. I mean, you have the Parker Mill, which was in 1887. That's one of the photos we're going to have. It's now a county park. That's amazing. And that was like a stone, or is a stone building, right? Stone foundation.
Yep. And that was a water powered cider mill. I think it was built in 1887. The grist mill is earlier. I think it was built on the foundations of an 1820s grist mill, and the Parkers were actually an English family. So that was one kind of thing that was interesting, was the number of immigrants from all over the world. I found a French cider making family in that came to Michigan in the 1840s. And they actually had a cider mill and a casket factory that was all in the same place.
You need that when you're having a funeral, you know, you got to salute the folks heading into the ground. Wow.
That's amazing. Parkers, though, they were from England and came over here and bought some property and opened up a mill, rebuilt the mill that was on their creek. And then in 1887, they added a cider mill. And one of the things, because I basically was doing a census of every cider mill that I could find, you can start to put together some pieces of like, what were people actually doing? You know, by the 1880s, most people don't think of that as prime cider making, the prime cider making era. Like, oh, cider was in decline by then. At least that's what the histories I've read say. But it seems to be the boom time here, when production seems to have been at its peak and everyone was trying to get in on it. And people just kept adding onto their cider mills or building new cider mills. And the Parkers were one of those families, an immigrant family that came. And then they're like, we need to add a cider mill to it. We've got this water power. Let's add a cider mill to it. And then they did that. And that operated for about 25 years.
And then we'll have a photo of the Dexter cider mill. That's the one you were talking about that was built by Civil War vets. It's the oldest continuing operated cider mill. That's just incredible. 1886. Here we are, that same time zone. And then the John Williams Cider House in 1867. I mean, and of course we'll have a photo of Martha Array Day and her family. Really appreciate your time and just how you're sharing this wealth of information. It means so much to so many people to be able to hear this.
Thank you, Rhea. I've always listened to your podcast and it's just a thrill to be on it.
I hope this conversation with Patrick McCauley has inspired you to look into your own special spot of Ciderville and see if there are some cider mills or apple orchards or makers that have been in that territory and their story has been forgotten. I just love how he brought out that piece on the Underground Railroad and the Martha Array Day family. Just amazing. And how about the Chicago Apple King, right? I don't know what Brian Rootson, who is Chicago cider himself, will think about that title, but I know he would like it. He's kind of our little Chicago Apple King anyways. But getting to the point, Ciderville, I have extra audio clips here. I do digress occasionally. Where I saved the tail end of my conversation with Patrick. It's actually about 18 minutes long. And in that, he is talking about how he hunted down the different apple trees and orchards, how he's continuing to do that, and what tools he's using. He also talked about the differing cider stories that take place in our American narrative on cider, and also what mills in the Ann Arbor area that you could go to load up on fresh pressed apple juice for your own cider making. And he is looking for some specific apple varieties in the area of Ann Arbor. So if you have maybe a very special tree, you might want to get to that special audio clip. You could find it at the Cider Chat Patreon page. And while you're there listening, it's going to be free to everybody. Why not consider becoming a patron of Cider Chat, because it's with this listener support that we get to keep Cider Chat on the air and now into season 7.
Bravo!
Oh, and don't let me forget, the Talking Palms are on that extra audio clip too. And they have a little special wish for all of you out there in Ciderville. Well, I think that's about it.
Roger that.
Well, Mr. Quince, we're going to head out of here. A little drum roll, please. Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to leave you here. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
We like cider. We like palms. We love orchards and having fun. There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh, yes, there is. There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider. We like palms. We like orchards. Having some fun.
There is a reason. There is a reason why we do it like this. Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh, yeah.
We like cider.
Oh, yes, we do.
We like palms.
Oh, yes, we do.
We love orchards. Having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum. Ba-da-da-dum.
We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh, yeah.
We like cider.
Ba-da-da-dum.
We like palms.
Oh, yes, we do.
We like orchards. Having some fun.
Yeehaw!